Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 883. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, at the Reformed Forum headquarters, in the office, in the studio, more specifically. And I'm happy to be back with a good friend of mine. We have Jim Cassidy, pastor of South Austin OPC in South Austin, Texas, and president of our board of directors here at Reformed Forum. Welcome back, Jim. It's great to see you.
Good to see you, Camden. This is great.
Yeah, we are broadcasting or streaming live onto YouTube. We're doing a bit of a test. We don't stream live very often. I enjoy it. It's a lot of work and trying to get everything lined up. And often we like to have the opportunity or at least the possibility of editing things. It usually puts our guests at ease. But Jim doesn't mind. Jim doesn't care anything what he says or what, and we don't need to edit anything. But we also wanted to run these tests to make sure that the live streaming is working on this platform because we've got some big announcements coming up. We're going to have a big live stream event on Friday, December 20th. More information on that in just a minute. Jim, I wanted to take a moment. As we record, it's Tuesday, November 26th. This episode should be out on Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. And we've got a bunch of things to mention. We've got some events coming up here at the year end. We're going to be in your neck of the woods December 5th and 6th in Dallas and Austin, respectively. We also are going to have this big event December 20th online, the Reform Forum Christmas Extravaganza, the first annual. My wife always says you're not allowed to say first annual. You have to have a second annual before you can say it's annual. But I'm going to buck the trend, and I'm going to throw away the advice and say we're having our first annual Christmas Extravaganza because I know it's going to be so great. And we're going to want to be.
There's going to be a second.
There's going to be a second. There must. It's imperative. There must. And
you know, you're. I mean, you're. This is dangerous waters that you're treading here. I mean,
yeah, not listening to my wife.
The advice of your wife is not. It's not advisable, Camden.
Always dangerous. The only time I would not listen to her is if we were playing rock and roll trivia or something like that, pop music trivia, then that's the only time I would never listen to her and just go with my gut. the other times, generally wise to listen to my better half. And but the bigger thing is, but even before we talk about some events and I go through some details, we have a very exciting sale going on now. And it's active if you're listening to this episode as it comes out in the podcast feed, or if you happen to be listening to it live or on YouTube in advance of Friday, Black Friday. So that would be, what is it, November 30th? Is Friday November 30th? I guess so, thereabouts. Anyway, for Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, we have a special sale. It's active even now, where if you head over to reformedforum.org/store, you'll be able to save big. Save big at reformforum.org/store. 25% savings on purchases over $50. Use code SAVE25, SAVE25 for that. Save 35% on purchases over $75. Use code, you guessed it, SAVE35. And finally, save 40% on purchases over $100. Use code SAVE40. Offers valid through Monday, December 2nd at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time in the U.S. So the whole store, I mean, if you order $100, you're going to save 40%. That's amazing. And we have two brand new books to mention and to announce. We've already had Dan Ragusa on Christ the Center to speak about his book, Fullness of Joy, but we have not yet announced or mentioned the release of Order in the Offices, second edition. That's available and it is beautiful. I regret I'm a total failure. I don't have a copy on hand right now and I'm not going to leave the chair to go back to my office and pick one up, but it's a hardcover book. It's amazing. It looks beautiful. We've got a new cover. It's Smith-sewn, cloth bound, has beautiful blue foil stamping on the spine. The paper's excellent. The typesetting is wonderful. We really did a good job on that. The team excelled in executing on publishing the second edition of Order in the Offices. This is a really important book. It was published first back in the 90s. It's a collection of articles and essays by different contributors on the subject of three offices, basically on the question and on the peripheral questions of whether ministers and elders are the same office or are indeed different offices. So if you're interested in that and you've always heard about three office and two office or two and a half office, you have questions about that and how ministers and elders relate to one another according to scripture and historic Reformed and Presbyterian polity, this is the book for you. Not only do we have everything that the first edition has, but in a really beautiful hardcover form that's going to last for ages. We also have an updated chapter by Greg Reynolds, and we have a new chapter that was written by Alan Strange on the subject of the three office view. So this is an excellent book. It's useful for all ministers, all elders out there, people in the church who want to learn more about ecclesiology and specific issues pertaining to these offices. It's a wonderful book, whether or not you even agree with the three office view. You're certainly going to want to read the articles or the chapters therein to get a grasp of the theological case that's being made. Jim, were you familiar with Order in the Offices? I know you're familiar, you're aware of it, but I mean, is that something you read back in the day? Is it something that you have used in your church or in officer training or anything of that nature?
Yeah, I have. I've used it in officer training, and my being familiar with it goes back quite a ways. I actually had the privilege of ministering about 45 minutes away from Hollidaysburg, Pennsylvania, where Mark Brown was the pastor when I was pastoring in Johnstown. And so I was supplied adequately by Pastor Brown with copies of Order in the Offices, and even had a chance to hear from him firsthand the story that is behind it. And of course, he recounts some of that in the new edition that we have coming out.
Yeah, we're so happy to have Mark's involvement and that he was interested and willing to have the book republished with us. And the copies of that are available now. You can order them at reformedforum.org/store. Retails at $34.99, but if you use one of these deals, you can save quite a bit. So package it with Fullness of Joy, with Regeneration and Redemptive History, all sorts of other books that we've published in the last couple of years. You can package them up together, give them to friends, and you certainly can save quite a bit. So we're really excited to have these in stock and available. Finally, many of the projects that we've been working on for 2 or 3 years are now getting to the finish line. And it's a joy to actually see something you've been working on for a couple of years and to hold it in your hand and to be able to share it with others. So we're really excited about that. Happy to share it. So we also have several events coming up. I'm trying to get in here into the live stream to make sure that I can. Here's the live control room. I'm a novice as it comes to this live streaming stuff. So it looks like we're in and we've got people watching live. Here we go. Very good. So I'm going to pause that. I don't need to watch that live stream because I'm on it, but I do want to see the chat. And we have 12 people watching now. Hopefully more will come on in the future. Jim, I don't know if you can get in there at all, but you can keep an eye on the chat as well. And I'm going to let the listeners know and the people in the chat that you can ask your questions and we'll do our best to try to answer them. We'll, of course, screen the ones out that are too hard for us. And we'll try to answer the others pretty soon. So let's go through some events. First off, December 5th, 2024, we're going to be having a meetup in Richardson, Texas. That's just outside of Dallas. We'd love to have you with us. We had a meetup in Dallas last year, and it went so well that we wanted to come back. So we're really excited to invite you to a Reform Forum meetup on Thursday, December 5th from 6 to 9 p.m. I've been working with one of our supporters, and we've got boots on the ground, so to speak. And in Texas, we quite literally could have boots on the ground. We're going to be meeting at Lockwood Distilling Company in Richardson, Texas, just outside of Dallas. We're going to have an informal gathering. It's a great opportunity to connect with fellow listeners and supporters and friends of Reform Forum. We have the patio. I guess it's reserved, and there are heaters out there. So even though it might get, who knows how chilly it'll get, certainly not as cold as it is in Illinois today. But we're going to have a covered patio where we can hang out and talk. You can, of course, grab a drink or a bite to eat. They have a really nice-looking menu, at least to me, all sorts of goodies on the list. So I'm going to be grabbing some snacks. And just come. It's casual. It's pay-as-you-go. And you'll be able to meet with me and Ryan Noah, other people that we're connecting with. We're trying to get a bunch of RTS students available and coming out. So if you're interested in talking about Reformed theology and history and other matters pertinent to the kinds of things we talk about here at Reformed Forum, come visit us Thursday, December 5th from 6 to 9 p.m. Central, Lockwood Distilling Co. in Richardson, Texas. We also have, we're going to be meeting with Jim in Austin. If you're connected to the church or thereabouts, we're going to be around, and you can reach out to somebody connected to the church or email us at mail@reformedforum.org for more information about things we might be up to and things that we're doing. I'm trying to spare you, Jim, so you don't get bombarded with a bunch of unknown people just showing up at your house or something like that. But we would love to connect with people in Austin, Texas or thereabouts, and we'd love to keep it weird with everyone down there.
That's going to be Friday night. I mean, that's fine for people to know, Friday night. Yes. Starting at around anytime after 6 p.m. Yep.
Right. So it's not at a public space. So if you're interested in around the South Austin area and would like to connect and come to an event, reach out to mail@reformedforum.org. We're just not posting all the details on the website just for, you know, semi-privacy sake. And unless you want to, Jim, but I wouldn't do it myself. But anyway.
The secrets of the kingdom.
We would love to have people, lots of folks from church and other, and from South Austin OPC will be around and hanging out. And I'll be there. Ryan Noah will be there. We're looking forward to it. So if you're interested and in the Austin area, Friday, December 6th will be that. Now, two more events, and then we'll get to the questions. December 20th, Friday, December 20th, we're going to be hosting a year-end Christmas extravaganza. This is in conjunction with our year-end giving campaign that we're going to be launching on Thursday. It will have already launched for those who are watching the live stream now, but mark your calendars for this special event, because on Friday, December 20th, Reform Forum will be hosting a four-hour live stream. It's a throwback to the old telethon format. It's like a variety show. So from 12 p.m. to 4 p.m. Central, 12 to 4 or 1 to 5 Eastern, we're going to celebrate God's faithfulness to the church and what he's been doing through Reform Forum, but we're also going to have a great time of fellowship and fun. We're going to be having a whole series of guests for this four-hour long podcast live stream. So I'm trying to break it down into 15-minute segments. And we're going to be welcoming people in and out. It'll be like a revolving door of a podcast. And we're going to have a big group of people. And some guests will come in to maybe talk about a book that they've written or a theological topic that they are thinking about and passionate about. We're going to try to open the lines up so we can have some listener call-ins and some interactive Q&A. We're going to have some testimonials. I'm trying to work with some of our friends overseas, potentially to have some of our Reformed brothers and sisters from Europe and other countries to call in and participate and tell us what the Lord is doing in their churches and in their areas. We're even scheduling some games. We're going to have some trivia challenges. We're working on getting some people to host like a wits and wagers style game, but a theologically driven one. And then I've got another game up my sleeve. We're going to have some fun surprises and maybe even a musical guest. So it's going to be quite the party, quite the experience. We intend, if everything works out technologically, we intend to live stream the entire thing Friday, December 20th, starting at noon Central Time here in the U.S. So mark your calendars, keep an eye on reformedforum.org for information about our Christmas extravaganza. Yay! I need the echo I need a board with the echo effect to add to that.
So. Hey, Captain, yeah. we're gonna need a sound effect too of the sound of phones ringing in the background. You know, like the
right.
Telethons.
We need like the stadium seating with the people answering the phones. Yeah.
Hello. Taking your donations.
I can't imagine any of those were actually real phones or real people. They're just like pretend conversations that people are having in the background of the studio.
They're all actors.
Yeah. Well, it is in conjunction. We want to make our fundraising fun. As Jim says, it's fundraising, but it's not just going to be a 4-hour long pitch. We're actually going to have a lot of content, a lot of fun, playing games, just having a good time at the year end. We like to do that ourselves, but we really haven't done that as a whole Reform Forum community, having any event like this. So we're really looking forward to working this out. And I've been at work sending people emails and trying to coordinate all these different segments for our extravaganza December 20th, 2024. Let's do it. All right. Well, let's get in. And finally, one last thing. We don't have all details finalized for this, like a location, but we are going to be hosting a theological seminar February 21st and 22nd, 2025 in Oklahoma City. We're still working on finalizing details at like a hotel meeting space. But if you're in the Oklahoma City area or willing to travel, it'd be a great time to come to Oklahoma City February 21st and 22nd, we're planning to have a Friday night meetup and a live podcast recording, and just a big get together with a live podcast recording. And we'll be bringing people with us. It'll be me, Ryan will be there. We're working on getting some of our faculty there as well. And then on Saturday morning, the morning after, we were going to be having some lectures. It'll be more accessible, more like our conference was at the end of September. It's not going to be the seminary or the doctoral level lectures, but it'll still be really theologically rich. And we can, of course, go as deep as anyone would like to go in the questions or in our personal interaction. But I don't want to scare any of our listeners or potential attendees away. That this is something you could come, and even if you're not theologically trained, you can gather a lot and learn a lot from. So we're really looking forward to hosting a seminar and doing kind of what we do, you know, bringing the meat and potatoes about redemptive historical theology, talking biblical theology and the revelation of Christ unfolding throughout all the pages of Scripture. So more details to come. I know it's getting close to that date, but we're working on these other events, and we'll have more information on our seminar in Oklahoma City, February 21st and 22nd. 2025. All right. Let's get into some questions. Let's see here. I don't have anyone screening these questions. I apologize, as I might have to pause and read some of these questions before we actually get it. Here's the first question, Jim. And this I'm sure is tongue in cheek, but it might get us to talk about some more serious and important things. First question from Reformed Apologetics. Do you guys agree with me that the OPC is the best denomination? Jim, do you have any comments or thoughts on that? We can riff on ecumenicity, I suppose, from that question. Thank you, Reformed Apologetics.
Yeah. Is it the best? It depends on the standard, right, upon which you judge a denomination or a church. So it really would depend on what your standard for that would be. I will say this, that I love the OPC. There's so much about it that I adore, and it might be in part because of personality. I'm sort of a small setting context type of person, and I like the intimacy, the closeness, the family feel of the OPC, the familiarity that we have with one another, and the commitment to confessional fidelity and to doctrine, and how we take our meetings serious. And when issues of theology arise, we debate those issues seriously and deeply. And I really enjoy that. I think that that's a sign of a good, healthy denomination. Now, all that being said, The OPC is just like every other denomination. It's not perfect. It has its foibles, and it has its imperfections, its sins, and everything else, just like every other church. So while I love the OPC, and I would be very hard-pressed and sad to ever have to leave the OPC, at the same time, it's the visible church of Christ still with a lot of indwelling sin. And so while I love it, I need to be very humble about my opinion of it too.
Sure. I appreciate that. I love the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. She is my mother in the ecclesiastical sense. And I love our history and our story. It's partly why I love serving as historian for as long as they'll have me. But you need to find there's certain table stakes, you know, in terms of finding a Reformed confession, finding a body. And previously I was a member of a church. I've only been a member of two denominations. I grew up in the mainline Presbyterian church. When I was in college, I attended all sorts of different evangelical churches. I never joined any of them because I was in college. I held my membership at the church where I grew up. And it wasn't until later, eventually, that I went off to seminary that I joined the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, partly because the church where I was attending while I was working at Caterpillar before going to seminary wouldn't allow me to join because I wouldn't get baptized as an adult because I was already baptized. So I want to, you know, make a point about different degrees of purity, as the Westminster Confession of Faith does, that there are certain table stakes when we're saying, is this denomination better or not? You know, at the time, I never have been a Baptist. I never was a Baptist, nor a communist, anything of the sort. I never had the conviction of a credo Baptist. And so then I never decided to get baptized again because I was already baptized as a child. And that prevented me from joining that church because they had other ecclesiological views, and I admired them and appreciated them for that. But knowing that I eventually there weren't necessarily Reformed churches nearby, and knowing also that I would be moving in a year or two to go to seminary, I just dealt with it. But for me, it was certainly better than for me to join with a denomination that held to Reformed creeds and confessions, and specifically the Westminster standards, because that was my own personal conviction that I felt that those standards most accurately represented the teaching of Scripture. So in that sense, I think it's better, but it's what is it better from or better than lesser forms? But then the question is, what about the variety of NAEPARC congregations? You have the OPC, the PCA, you have the RCUS, you name it. We could go through the whole list, the ARP. There's a ton of them. So I don't want to name any more because then I'm going to be leaving others out. But the question then is, how do those compare with one another? And those are other questions. There are finer points of distinction, different emphases, different histories, different cultures. But generally speaking, a lot of it depends on the local church. It depends on your particular needs, depends on the pastor who might be at that specific church. There's a whole other set of factors involved where, you know, I might be more comfortable in certain PCA churches than I would be in other OPC local churches. Once you get to the level of having a certain theological standard, Jim, I don't know how you feel about this, but then there's definitely overlap, significant overlap among many of the different denominations. And it's really hard to, and probably not the most fruitful exercise, to say one denomination is better than the other. Like, I have my convictions. I believe the way that we do foreign missions in principle is better than the way that other churches do it. I like the way that we do our General Assembly and send commissioners and do those sorts of things. Do I think that's better? Generally, in principle, yes, but we also have a unique history and unique circumstances. So I don't know. That's kind of how I approach the question. If the OPC did not exist, I would be very happy to be serving in another faithful American Presbyterian denomination. And I'd be sad that the OPC didn't exist, but I wouldn't feel like I was necessarily greatly impoverished either, if that's not too strong to say. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree. Once again, we hear this said all the time. The OPC does not stand for the only perfect church. So that's something we need to bear in mind. And there, every body is going to have its own particular distinctive strengths and features to mm-hmm. them that are attractive to the members that are there. And there's R.B. Kuiper is well known for talking about the multiformity of the church, mm-hmm. that it is both singular but also diverse. There's unity and diversity within the Church of Christ. We are one according to the Spirit and according to our doctrine with our brothers and sisters and other Napart denominations. But there's also diversity as well. And that's something that, while we may have disagreements that form part of that diversity, nevertheless, it's something that we do not need to become proud about either. So mm-hmm.
I think diversity is extremely helpful here, provided it's that we have unity and diversity that's all based on the unity needs to be based on the truth. But I find that the various diversity, the diversity that we find in proper ecumenicity is extremely helpful. And I just am reminded of the benefit that the Dutch influence had upon the OPC in the 1940s, especially as they were being really influenced by American cultural influences to become a more American evangelical church, one that was culturally influential, maybe politically active, socially active, all these kinds of things, really trying to become an American church, a national church, and how the Dutch influences really prevented them from kind of succumbing to what we would see as kind of a mistake, succumbing to an error and kind of losing your pilgrim identity. And it's because the Dutch guys came from a different background and they were Americans. Like Ned Stonehouse was born in the United States. I mean, but he's comes from a Dutch family and grew up in Grand Rapids, but because of their cultural heritage and background, they weren't necessarily susceptible to some of these other arguments about, I don't know, teetotaling, you know, prohibition, trying to, you know, get on board with a national evangelical movement and stuff like that. And so the diversity can be helpful there, whereas we have more interaction with people in other denominations yet who have similar theological concerns. As we fellowship with other people in NAPARC especially, and then worldwide in groups like ICRC, we end up becoming better versions of our own tradition, I think. So all the guys that I've, all my friends, my brothers in the URC, the more time I spend with them, they make me a better Presbyterian. And I'd like to think that I, through my influence, would make them better Continental Reformed guys. And so it's a mutual benefit where you can sharpen one another because you're both coming at things from a shared theological faith commitment, but at the same time, maybe having a slightly different perspective on that or slightly different historical context in it, on different particular issues, which ultimately makes us better. It's kind of the same thing that we have in biology with a monoculture. You don't want a monoculture. That's not good. You know, if all the corn we have in the United States is the same exact genetics, like that's not a good idea.
Right. And, you know, we have to recognize that not everybody is going to think this exactly the same right. way we do think within a confessional framework, mm-hmm. right? About every single thing. And right. so if we expect and get disappointed when other people think differently than we do about sort of those in-house issues, mm-hmm. then that's going to result in a strange form of tribalism, mm-hmm. right? Where it's sort of like, or monoculture, as you said, it's, that's not necessarily a great thing because we need iron sharpening iron. And in order for that to happen, we need to have others that we trust, brothers and sisters in the Lord, that we can have those sharpening conversations with, to even if it just results in us sharpening and honing our particular convictions that give us our own distinctive personal flavor.
Yeah. Here's a question for you, Jim, from Joseph Chin. Thank you, Joseph. Can you ask Jim, Mr. Cassidy, to talk about what Bart meant by distinguishing the sun in concreto and the sun in abstracto, and how this understanding directs Bart's understanding of election? Are you familiar with that specific issue or something related?
Going back, I mean, I've been sort of moving on and thinking about other things since I wrote my dissertation on Bart. So I'm just kind of refreshing my memory. But so it sounds more like a question you would get in a PhD comprehensive exam than a curiosity question. But it's a good question because it really does go at the heart, as everything Bart does. And I'm not going to wax on very long with regard to Bart's theology, but with everything in Bart's theology, it all sort of has its center, and arguably his Christology is the center of his theology. And in his Christology, he talks a lot about, and not just in, like, let's say the loci of his theology under Christology, because it extends throughout. It's in the entirety of the church dogmatics. It informs every loci of his theology. So, but he's always talking about, he's well known for talking about and rejecting the idea of the logos asarkos, the idea that there is a eternal person who can ever be conceived in terms of being abstracted from the incarnation and from his human nature. So for Bart, there is in essence no logos asarkos. There's only really the logos in sarkos, the logos incarnate, the son incarnate. So to translate the question from the question, the son in abstracto would be sort of like the logos asarkos. The idea of the sun in abstract form, disconnected from the act of God, the saving act of God, the grace of God in Jesus Christ. And so the sun, understand in concreto, has the notion of the incarnation of view. It's the sun incarnate. And now for Bart, there really is no time or no conceivable moment in which you can have a logos or the eternal son in abstraction from or apart from the flesh and the incarnation. That's just who God is. God is the God who elects in his grace humanity in the humanity of Jesus Christ. And that is the in concreto part. So his doctrine of election not being abstract and sort of eternal, but concrete and temporal in the humanity of Christ.
It's a bit different from, like, Karl Rahner, the guy that I studied for my PhD, will in many ways collapse the economic conception of the Trinity into the immanent. He thinks that they're effectively the same thing. His idea was, he didn't want to think that the Trinity as revealed in history, and specifically in salvation history, that Trinity is nothing different from the eternal Trinity. But he sees the Son and Spirit as divine self-communications of the Father. And this is a different idea, though. So Rahner is not going to have this notion of the eternal incarnation. But he also has this idea of kind of like, he turns what traditionally theologians might call the immanent Trinity, and economizes it, that there's no logical distinction between God in and of himself and God in relation to the world and acting in history. Bart seems at least formally similar to me in terms of having that economy that's always present eternally. Is that fair enough to say, at least at a formal level?
Yeah, I think that's right. One clarification about what I said: the incarnation is not so much eternal as it is transcendent, right? Mm. It's a transcendent event or an act of God, whereby God chooses to be for us in Jesus Christ. Right. So that's where election and the incarnation come into contact, mutually informing one another. We would say, maybe we would say dialectically informing one another, or informing each other in a correlative kind of way, mutualism, if you will. Election and the incarnation are all of it kind of converges together in a transcendent event for Karl Barth.
We have a related question here that came up. Diego Correa asks this. He says, I am a Reformed, I presume a Reformed church member in Honduras. He's at a Presbyterian church there. He says he has a question. I'm studying Karl Barth in German. Do you recommend him? Thank you for all the videos. Helpful indeed. So we can, obviously you spent hundreds, thousands of hours of your life studying Karl Barth. And, you know, I've spent hundreds of minutes. No, I'm kidding. More than that. Many, many hours myself. I remember when I was a student for one of my external courses at the Catholic University of America, they asked me, you know, where I come from and what kind of church I was, because I wasn't a Catholic. And I said, oh, I'm Reformed. You know, I'm a Presbyterian. And but when I said Reformed, they said, oh, like Karl Barth, right? So they thought the OPC and Karl Barth were effectively, in their mind, in the same camp. How might you respond to maybe that kind of question? And what are some of the, at least from a sketch, broad-based general, you know, vantage point, what are some things to be concerned about with Karl Barth?
Yeah, I mean, Karl Barth's not only not Reformed, he's not Christian. Mm-hmm. I mean, his theology, right? So, and Van Til's right when he says that it's that Karl Barth's theology is essentially anti-theistic, right? So, you know, is Barth worth reading? Is he worth studying, considering, whatever? Yes, you almost have to. It's sort of like Thomas Aquinas. He's so large upon the field of theology, Christian theology, so-called Christian theology in the most generic sense of the word, that you have to reckon with him. But you want to be quite careful, I think, to understand not only what Barth is saying, but the implications of what he's saying. Okay, so there are sort of logical consequences to the proposals that Karl Barth places before us in his church dogmatics. And we have to ask ourselves whether or not those implications, those logical deductions that come from the express statements that he says, are really the kinds of things that are healthy for not just Christian theology as a discipline, but particularly for the church. And there are a number of reasons why the answer to that has to be no. And I'll just go ahead and say this. When Machen wrote Christianity and Liberalism, of course, the great thesis of the book is that Christianity and liberalism are not two different forms of the same religion. They're two different religions altogether that are opposed to each other. Van Til said the same thing, in essence, when he wrote his book, Christianity and Barthianism. That was his point, that Barthianism is really just another form of modernism or liberalism recast in different terms. And there are reasons for that, and it's taken me virtually a lifetime to figure out what exactly Van Til meant by that. And it's worth exploring. It's worth reading Barth in one hand and Van Til and his commentary on Barth's theology on the other, because I think you'll be able to hone your gift of discernment and be able to see what are the implications that Barth's proposals naturally, logically lead to. Mm-hmm. And they really are anti-Christian to the core, anti-theistic, in fact.
Thanks, Jim. Here's a little bit of a palate cleanser before we transition to a more practical academic question. Sounds like a contradiction, but a practical question about academics. Rob Barker, our friend, says, he asks you, Jim, I presume, is Steve Cohen going to lock down Juan Soto before Christmas?
No.
I think you muted yourself, brother.
This is a very important question. This is that upon which all the hopes of Mets fans currently hang. It is the question greater of which none can be conceived.
All your hopes, the only thing your Mets hopes ever do is injure the player that you placed your hopes upon. That's what happens. The weight of those hopes just cripples a man.
It comes crashing down.
I mean, Jose Reyes, David Wright. I mean, how many people do I have to name like that you're always hoping for? And I feel bad for the guy that's the subject of attention of the Mets fans. I feel for the Mets fans, but my goodness. So is this deal going to happen? What's your take?
Well, right now, all the pundits are saying that the Mets are leading in the contention to get him signed. Whether or not he'll do it before the end of the year, I don't know. But look, it's not going to come down to a matter of money. That's what we know, right? It's money's not an object. It's going to be whether or not Soto wants to sign and be with the Mets or with somebody else for some other reason. So it's not going to be an issue of money.
You got that Bernie Madoff heritage and legacy around it. There's plenty of money to go around with the Mets. We appreciate that. Yeah, exactly. They're just printing it there in Citi Field. All right, Max CG asks, he says, I started a master's degree in September at my seminary in France, and I'm working on union with Christ in the Gospel of Matthew. Interesting. Do you have any academic advice to give me? Thank you, and God bless. Jim, maybe we could start off maybe not specific academic advice for Max. We can get specific, but what are some general thoughts that you would have for someone pursuing a seminary degree or maybe a master's degree with a particular research focus? What are some, maybe I can even frame it this way, what are some things you wish you would have known as you were commencing your own PhD work?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. In terms of PhD doctoral work, one of the best pieces of advice I think I received at the outset of my program was to already at least get in my mind a candidate for a dissertation topic, so that everything that I did in my, this is sort of a strategy thing, everything I did in terms of my coursework, and all of it depends, right, on sort of like where you're doing the degree, because the way that they do doctoral programs in England, for example, Great Britain, is altogether different than the way that we do it here in America, right? It's like there they throw you right into research and you're on your own, it's independent. You're sort of going to conferences, you're writing papers, you're thinking about this, that, or the other thing, communicating with your advisor, beginning the process already of researching your dissertation. In the US, you got to go through coursework first, and then you get into the actual writing cheat. Of the dissertation. What's it?
There's a hack that I did that you can do if you work out your coursework.
Yep.
The paper you write for that course could eventually be reused or adapted for the dissertation.
That's exactly where I was heading. Okay, there you go. That's exactly right. Right. So that's
I need to trust you, brother. I need to trust where you're leading me.
That's exactly what I was thinking. And that's sort of that's what I did. Almost every paper that I wrote during my coursework intersected with BART, right? So it was like right at the outset, I was already thinking of researching BART. So that by the time I got to the writing of the research and the writing of the dissertation, that ended up getting minimalized.
Yeah, that's good. I would say in general, you got to stay focused. It's hard work. I think whether it's a master's degree, you know, of whatever kind, an MAR, an MA, a THM, or a PhD, especially if there's a research component to it, which it sounds like there is for this particular master's degree. You got to stay focused and stay focused on your topic. There's a certain amount of knowledge you have to know about the field and other issues. I'm not saying put on your blinders. Try to understand your topic in relation to other topics. But it's much better to stay focused and to remain locked onto your topic. It's better to go deeper than it is to be a mile wide and an inch deep. And I think the tendency, especially when you're in a program and you have friends or other classmates and people are talking about this thing or that thing, or they're asking you, what about this debate? Or have you read this book? You can get pulled in a million directions and you might feel tempted that you need to somehow catch up or to stay abreast of a million other topics that all your classmates are dealing with. I find that that'll pull you away from going deep in the specific issue that you want to go deep into. So don't feel like you have to have something intelligent to say about everything. Just don't worry about that. You can get to that stuff later. Focus on your topic and then start working backwards. If you're dealing with your topic and you're finding that you're hitting a roadblock or you don't understand something, then do the necessary, the requisite work to fill your knowledge out at that point. But don't try to keep up with the Joneses from a knowledge perspective. It's a fool's errand, and you'll end up wasting your time. We're not making any progress. And a lot of guys do that and they flame out. They don't finish their program because they weren't disciplined, diligent, focused on that particular topic and doing what needed to be done to graduate.
Right.
So yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, remember, it's sort of like a job, right? I mean, you got a job to do. Get it done and get on with your life, because not only is life waiting for you to get on with it, but also it's like there's other things that you're going to learn and can learn in your career, whatever that might be. And I'll just say this, it's sort of maybe a pietistic element to all of this, right? Especially when you think about seminary. The reason why you're doing this is not as an end in itself, right? Academics, in your mind, ought not to be an end in itself so that you can have greater knowledge and you can say that you've got greater knowledge. But it's unto a greater end, which is service to Christ and his church, so that you can serve his people better. And if you think that way about it, then that's going to help you in terms of keeping in focus and in perspective your successes and failures as an academic.
Excellent. There's another thing I would say. This is a more practical and tactical answer to this question. Get your tech in order. If you may or may not be a tech kind of person, and not everyone is, but there's a certain baseline level of tech that you're going to need to know just to manage your life as a researcher. Number one, it's your bibliographic sources. You need to have that stuff stored. Don't even think about doing any of that manually. Do yourself a favor if you haven't already and go get Zotero. You can find other platforms that you can pay for or others that might have a free version, but there's an open source project and it's become quite the standard. Zotero, Zotero.org, and you can get the application, and then there are plugins and extensions that you can install in your browser, especially in Chrome. I use, and I've been using and storing all of my sources in Zotero for ages. And then you can install a plugin for Microsoft Word, and I presume other word processors as well. So to give people an idea of why this is handy, when I'm reading a book or I'm researching, I'll go to worldcat.org or go to the library website or go to Amazon, and in the top of my browser, there'll be a little button with a book, and I hit it and it will pull all the bibliographic information into Zotero, my bibliographic source manager. Then I go and I make sure it's all correct and that everything is capitalized correctly, that the publication date's right, the author's name spelled right, all that. I just verify the information is accurate in comparison to the book I'm holding or reading, if it's like an ebook or something like that. I just make sure it's right. But once it's in my system, it's in my system. Now, as I'm taking notes, I have an entire system I won't bore you with, but I have an entire way of keeping track of all my notes as I'm reading and all of my thoughts upon the book as I'm reading. In the field, we call this literature notes. As I'm writing literature notes, I have a way of storing that. But here's the big payoff. When I'm writing in Word and I want to cite a source, I just hit a keyboard shortcut or I hit the button in my menu on Word, and then it brings up a dialogue. I search for the book or the paper that I want to cite. and I type in the page number or the page numbers that I'm citing, hit enter, and it adds a footnote, and it's all properly sourced and properly formatted according to, for me, Chicago style, MLA style, Turabian, because that's the style we use in my field. But other people could use APA or SBL, whatever you're using. You can define the style you want for that particular document. So I never have to worry about, do you put a comma here or a period here or the long reference or the short reference? Is this the first time this is mentioned in my document, or can I use a shorter reference later? You know, I don't have to think about any of that. I just have to make sure that my data is correct in my database. And then from there, all my citations will be updated and accurate. I've known so many students and still friends, maybe some that are on the program with me right now, who still probably do lots of their citations manually. I just don't understand why you would put yourself through that when there's a free and easy to use program. So I'd say, brother, get your academic tech in order. And I won't talk about it now, but I would also highly encourage you to look into this weird underworld online called PKM, or Personal Knowledge Management, and look at a program called Obsidian, also free, as a way to write your notes. So as you're reading and researching, look in the principles of PKM and Zettelkasten, and looking at more advanced ways of taking notes and relating your notes to one another. That will prove immensely valuable for the long run when you have all of your notes in one place and it's all organized well. It's going to be good for you. So I'll leave it at that. Any follow-up, Jim? Sorry to bust your chops a little bit. I don't know how you do your citations. You probably handle them well. I'm just using you as a whipping boy.
I'm used to it. It's fine.
Yeah.
Actually, I use Zotero back when I was in the doctoral program.
Yeah, it's so good. It's so good.
Program, but I haven't used it though in a long time, in part because I haven't undertaken an extensive research project the way I did. But anyway,
Well, the other nice thing is when you're all done, you just tell it, spit me out a bibliography. It'll print the whole thing, all in order. Like it'll all be correct. And you just copy and paste that into the end of your thesis or your dissertation. So, and it's handy, not just for the academics, anyone out there who wants to track what they're reading and write notes that are attached to a specific reference. So Zotero is the way to go. It's really, really, really handy, useful. All right, here's another question. This one can be a little tricky. It's another practical question, has practical import. But Tony Paul asks us, Jim, what is the biblical basis for a minister being the member of a presbytery instead of a local church? So for reference, at least in the OPC and the PCA, I take it, it's pretty common in American Presbyterianism for the ministers to be members of their presbytery, or what we call in the OPC the regional church, rather than being a member of the local church. So all ministers are a member of a church. It's just they're members of a regional church rather than a local church, whereas all other church members, ruling elders and deacons included, are members of local churches. And this is not the case in the continental tradition, certainly at least in the Dutch Reformed tradition. So I know that CRC ministers of the past and currently URC NA ministers are still members of local churches. Jim, are you aware of any of this historically, or the biblical reasons for one or the other?
The short answer is that I don't have a great answer. I do have maybe a provisional outline answer that can be fact-checked and corrected by our listening audience.
Sure.
So I think, first of all, within the history of the Reformed Church, particularly with the distinction between ministers and elders, which of course speaks to our new book, The Order in the Offices, comes this idea that the office of minister is like unto that of the prophetic office, sort of like an office of the word, like prophets and apostles, but not prophets and apostles, but analogically related to the apostles and the prophets. And then if you see the way in which you have the elders sort of join with them, what you see is that the prophets and the apostles sort of have a distinct, if I could use the language of, I think this is the language that you find in Geneva, of a sort of college of pastors. Okay, and by college, we just
company.
Mean,
yeah,
just a company, a group, a fraternity, maybe you might say. And I think that historically, the ministers were the ones that particularly formed the core of the consistory in Geneva. And now, ruling elders, of course, were added to the consistory. And somewhat at the from my understanding, somewhat at the instigation of the city council. So there were elders that were put on the consistory who were also members of the city council, and they were there to represent the interests of the city on the consistory of the church that made up the entire religion of the city. And so I think that that's sort of maybe a little bit of the biblical historical background. There is a practical reason why I think this is also the case. Of course, there are a number of Reformed denominations that don't do it this way. A number of Reformed denominations actually have the pastor or the minister with their membership in the local congregation. But I think practically speaking, one of the reasons why is because we understand that the pulpit is supplied by the presbytery, and therefore the presbytery has oversight of the pulpit ministry of the local church, which provides two things. Number one, it's a protection. It's a protection for the congregation so that if the minister ends up either failing in doctrine or life, the presbytery has the power to remove him, as it were, from above, right? And to offer checks and balances so that the members of the local church always have a higher court of appeal if, in fact, they're dissatisfied with the ministry of their pastor. But also, it protects the pastor or the minister from the people. So in other words, in our system, the congregation can't just fire the pastor, okay? The presbytery is the one that is in charge of dissolving the call of the minister. So let's say if the minister, and I think about the situation with Jonathan Edwards, where it was sort of like Edwards, wisely or not, decided to preach against the sins of like the children of some of the members of the church. And they ran him out of town, basically. And you could do that in a congregational form of government, but you can't do that in a consistently Presbyterian form of government. You can't just run the pastor out of town because you don't like what he has to say from the pulpit if what he's saying from the pulpit is biblical and true. So I think that some of the wisdom, the practical import of this arrangement is so that the congregation is protected from a potentially abusive pastor, and the pastor is protected from a potentially abusive congregation.
Yeah, those are really good points. I don't have much to add other than maybe a few other pragmatic answers. But I would I will preface what I say with I don't readily at my fingertips have this all worked out to present, although we could present some things. I would encourage people to study Acts 14 and 15 and maybe looking at Acts 14, Titus 1 and Acts 20 as well. You start to look at the function of the ministers and what they were doing. They didn't necessarily belong, so to speak, to one local congregation, but were more at work at large. Now, this is a New Testament early church era where we do have the work of apostles and special office of evangelist and other types of things too. So I don't mean to say that there's an exact one-to-one correspondence, but clearly there's this laying on of hands on people for ordained ministry. and there's a parity or a peer system kind of at that level, and then an installation for people to be working in a specific context. But the minister's credentials don't reside, properly speaking, in a local context. They belong to the church more as a whole. And then in the Presbyterian form of government that we have, particularly the version that we have in the United States, historically speaking, it has been presbyteries or regional churches that do the credentialing. So your presbytery is the one that examines a man to see whether he is suitable for gospel ministry and to verify his call and examine him, and then eventually to ordain him and then to install him in a specific church. Now, here's a pragmatic response that might sound arrogant or something. It isn't meant this way, but there's a question of where are the minister's peers? And this goes back to Jim's question or Jim's point about Jonathan Edwards and protecting a minister from the church. Let's say a minister is accused of sin, you know, or let's say even more specifically, a minister is accused of doctrinal error. You know, where are his peers as one who is particularly called and installed, particularly gifted, we presume, called and then installed to be in the teaching office? So that's what a minister is, more aligned with the prophets in this regard, that he has a specific calling and a qualification and a giftedness from the Lord to be teaching. Who is competent? Again, this isn't a biblical case so much. I'm not giving you chapter and verse, but just think about this from a principled standpoint. Who is competent to adjudicate such a charge, right? And it's not to say that the local church is not equipped to deal with doctrinal error. They are. The Lord provides. The Lord's Spirit is with His people, and especially with ruling elders. And we can deal with theological errors at the sessional level. But if the minister's credentials are held with the presbytery, that's his court of original jurisdiction, and that's where his peers are. And so if there happens to be a problem with a minister, or at least if one is charged to be delinquent or deficient in doctrine or life, who needs to investigate that and look into it further and adjudicate the matter? From this position, it would be the presbytery or the regional church. And then he also has a court of appeal too, in case he's found guilty and believes that was a judgment in error, then he can appeal that case to the General Assembly. So I don't know. Would you agree with that, Jim, or have any other take or additional information on that side of things?
No, I think that's right. We are ministers of the word, and the office carries with it sort of an authority of doctrine. Mm-hmm. And again, like you said very adequately, it's not that the people in the pews don't know doctrine or shouldn't know doctrine or be or excel in knowledge of doctrine. Right. Of course they should. And of course, ruling elders should as well. But we also recognize that the presbytery is a higher court of appeal. And so if you have members of a local church or a session who calls into question the doctrine of the pastor, then that needs to be adjudicated somewhere. Are you going to give it to a court of people who don't hold to the office of minister, hold to the office of the word? No, you're going to give it to those who have the office of the word, because it's the ministry of the word.
And those who are representing the churches that comprise that body as well. So ruling elders who are duly sent to presbytery would certainly have a vote and weigh in on the matters.
Yeah, but of course.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's good. We've got a couple more questions here. That's an excellent question, and perhaps no doubt is deserving of a full episode and a more thorough historical and exegetical case. So we hope to revisit that. It's interesting to me. A couple quick hitters we got from our friend Bo. Love Bo. What are Jim's three favorite systematics? Jim, can you list off the top of your head your three favorite systematic theologies or series?
Sure. Yeah. Calvin's Institutes, Bavinck's Reformed Dogmatics, and Voss's Reformed Dogmatics.
I like it. I don't think I would differ with you on any of that. Although there's a lot to be said about Turretin at times, at points. There are single volumes that are really helpful. I think of Van Til's Intro to Systematic Theology is not your traditional systematic theology. It's kind of maybe mistitled, but he brings a lot to the table and brings some things on Trinitarian theology that Bavinck also talks about, but he brings them out in a unique way that's very helpful and useful. But those are some excellent titles there. Obviously, Murray has some useful stuff. Hodge is amazing. But certainly with Calvin and Bavinck, you can't go wrong. Voss is tremendous, but I would put Voss third on that list. I think he does bring some unique things there, and it's wonderful, but you're covering most all your bases with Calvin and Bavinck for sure, I think. Here's a question, a more serious one, coming from the Van Tillian side. Is Gordon Clark worth reading, and what does he bring to the table? Well, I think he's worth reading. I think I know if Lane were here, he might recommend or at least acknowledge Gordon Clark's book From Thales to Dewey. So there are some historical works that Bavinck will describe the history of Western philosophy and some of the philosophers and the issues involved in a very helpful way. So that could be a useful thing to read. I, of course, as a Van Tillian, have my reservations about Gordon Clark and his rationalism, his rejecting of fiducia or trust as an aspect of saving faith, I think is a major problem. You know, you have your three elements of saving faith, knowledge, assent, and trust. And he very famously kind of rejected the idea that trust was one of them. So there are other issues with Clark, but I could say that he could be a reliable guide in terms of the history of Western philosophy. Any other thoughts, Jim? He doesn't want to say anything. I don't see. Nothing to add. That's good.
Nothing to add. He's, you know, philosophical works may be one thing if you're thinking about a sort of a helpful guide in the area of theology, probably not so much.
And we've got a fun one. Who does Camden think has a more miserable fan base right now, Michigan or Alabama? I think it actually, if you would have asked me early last week, I would have said Michigan. But Alabama, I think, has the more miserable fan base right now, especially not just because of the more recent loss. But their standards are so high. You guys are just coming back to reality. You still have an excellent program and a great and bright future. It's just you've been living in the clouds for so long, you got used to it, and it's not realistic. So just get used to, you know, most of your seasons having two or three losses. And once in a while, you know, every 5 years, you have the special one-loss title run. I maybe that's the future, maybe that's not. Michigan has a not as bright of a future as Alabama. I think moving forward, Alabama's in a great place. But we did just flip the nation's number one recruit at quarterback, Bryce Underwood, with this long saga and drawn-out NIL stuff. So that has been a bright spot in a dismal year. So see, we have no quarterback that can throw the ball. I still think Michigan still is the only team in college football that doesn't have a pass play of 40 or more yards. Just think about that. Played 11 games and still doesn't have a pass play longer than 40 yards. I think that's still true. It was true last week, and I don't recall them getting one against Northwestern. But the future is bright, because if we have the nation's number one recruit, who also is a quarterback and the best offensive recruit Michigan has had in more than 20 years, we can put all of our hopes and trusts in him, just like you and Juan Soto, Jim. But hopefully our hopes don't crush this man under the weight of our unreasonable expectations. Or rather, he can lift them up and hold them high, just like our our friend JJ McCarthy did for us for a couple of years. All right. I apologize to all the people who don't like all the sports references. We don't do this very often, but we do it in private. We just don't do it on the program. It's been fun. Jim, thanks for stopping. Thanks for taking a time here before the holiday break to talk. We really appreciate it. Let me remind people of the things we have going on. Again, the Black Friday sale, it's going to be running through December 2nd. You can save up to 40% off on purchases over $100. Use code SAVE40. But if you're not going to buy $100 worth of stuff, you can save 25 or 35% respectively. Check that out. Head over to reformforum.org/store to save money on our books, including the new brand new titles, Order in the Offices, Second Edition, and Fullness of Joy. And then we have several events. The most immediate is Thursday, December 5th, 2024 in Richardson, Texas. December 6th, in South Austin, Texas. December 20th, the giant Christmas extravaganza on Reform Forum from 12 to 4 p.m. Central, the big live stream. And then February 21 and 22 in the year 2025 in Oklahoma City for a seminar. There's a lot going on there. But Jim, we're excited to keep on and to work on into a new year. It's been another great one. We are thankful for all of our listeners and our donors. And I'm very thankful for you and for your work here as a faculty member, as a board member, and as a panelist here in Reform Forum. Thanks for joining me today, bud.
Yeah, privilege. This was fun. Yeah. Good job by the way, great job by our listeners asking great questions.
Yes, amen. We like this. It's actually worked. So I think I've got I always believed in the listeners, but I didn't believe in this tech or in my ability to use it. So it seems like we might have this in order. So we might do another test or two of a larger scale, but hopefully on December 20th, we'll be able to rock and roll for 4 hours with a really special event. Head on over to reformedforum.org for more information on what we have going on. You can subscribe to our email newsletters there. If you'd like to get in touch with us, we have a contact form, and we have a whole host of courses, publications, podcasts, events, all sorts of things, all available at reformedforum.org. I want to thank everybody for listening. Thank you for participating in the live stream and for watching. And we hope you all join us again next time on Christ the Center.